So this week we come to the final parasha of Chumash Bereishis, parasha of Vayechi, and the beginning of Vayechi, Yaakov has his famous request of Yosef, Al Natak Bereini B'Mitzrayim. He doesn't want to be buried in Mitzrayim, he wants to be buried in Eretz Canaan for numerous reasons. Rashi quotes some and Mefarshim add others. And then in Pasuk Lamed Aleph, the beginning of the parasha, Perek Mem Zayin, Pasuk Lamed Aleph, Vayom Yishavali, he asks Yosef to swear to him, Vayishavali, he does, Vayishtachu Yisrael al Rosh Hamita. And Yisrael, that is Yaakov, bows down towards the top end of the bed, al Rosh Hamita. It's a very specific expression. And Rashi actually gives two explanations as to what's behind this positioning. And the first comment that Rashi makes, Mikan, from here we learn, Amru Shashchina Lamala Miroshosav Shelchoda, that the Shechina is present at the headstead, by the head of someone who is ill, someone who is sick. That actually is a concept which has halachic ramifications. I would say halacha, but not halacha lemaisa. In two respects. Firstly, the famous Gemara, which says that one should not, if one is davening beichidus, one should not daven in Aramaic. The malachim have issues with Aramaic, and they don't receive it, they don't convey it. When one is betzibur, the malachim are not involved at all in conveying the tefillahs, and therefore all those things that we say betzibur in Aramaic, Kaddish and Brich Shemei and Yukum Perkin and all of those things. However, says the Gemara, if a person visits someone who is sick, there's no problem for him to daven in Aramaic because the Shechina is right there direct. That's a halachic ramification, as the Gemara describes in Masechah Shabbos and Daf Yud. Again, I would say it's halacha v'lo lemaisa, because I'm not sure how many of us naturally would burst into prayer in Aramaic in that spontaneous way. Perhaps unless we didn't want the patient to know exactly what we were saying. Secondly, and also another again halacha, is that one shouldn't sit higher than the one who is sick. And that's something which was, again, nogea in more in the times of the Gemara, because if a person was lying down, they were often lying down on the floor or on a mattress on the floor. Under those circumstances, if you sit down, you need to sit on the floor because the Shechina is by their head and you shouldn't be higher than the Shechina. Again, nowadays, people, or if they're in a bed, that's probably the same level as a chair. But it's important to realize the concept shouldn't go missing, even as the halachic ramifications are perhaps less practicable. In any case, this is, according to the first parish of Rashi, is what is behind Yaakov bowing in this way. Hashchina lamala miroshosav shel chole. The Shechina is by the head of the chole. What's interesting is, the Pasuk never says that he's sick. The Pasuk just says that he called Yosef. It does say, Vayikruvu Yemei Yisrael Lamus. It does say that his end appeared. But it never actually says that he's sick. And it is especially interesting, because if you look at the very next Pasuk, which is whoever divided the chapters has made that into a new chapter, Perek Mem Ches, Pasuk Aleph, Vayhi Acharei HaDvarim Ha'eleh, after these, the initial meeting, Vayomer LeYosef, Hine Avicha Chole. Afterwards, and in fact, Acharei, as we've noted already numerous times, even recently, Acharei means a while after, as opposed to Achar, which is shortly after. So that's very interesting. Why is Rashi explaining the first episode based on the idea that Yaakov was sick, when that is something which is not reported until a good while later on? An interesting shaila. And this question was raised by Reb Zalman Sorotskin in his Sefer Oznaim LaTorah. And he says the answer to this matter is based, or we found in a medrash, it's a medrash in a number of places, I think a Pirkei de Belezer even. And that is that Yaakov was the first person ever to be sick. In the sense that until his time, people became old. The Pasuk says, Va'avraham zakein. But in terms of a kind of a decline prior to passing from this world, that didn't exist. The way the Pirkei Be'elezer says it is that a person would simply sneeze and they would expire. The soul would exit the way it entered. Vayipach ba'apav nishmas chayim. In the same way that the soul was breathed into through the nostrils of man, that's how it would exit. It's for this reason that there is a tradition, and it goes back already to the times of the Gemara, of wishing a person well when they sneeze. In the times of the Gemara, they would say asuta. Asuta is Aramaic for refuah. And they would say, they should say it should be a refuah, because back in the day, it was not a refuah. It was the end. Nowadays, we've changed from asuta, which would be refuah, to labriut, same idea. The Sfardim, interestingly, have a somewhat more elaborate tradition. If someone sneezes, it's a bit of a procedure. All of those who are there when they sneeze, so they say to him, Chayim Tovim. To which he responds to the well-wishers, Yosifu Lachem Shnot Chayim. All of this is recorded in the Sefer Knesset HaGadola of Reb Chaim ben Benisti, one of the great Sfardi Gadolim. They say to him, Chayim Tovim. He says to them, Yosifu Lachem Shnot Chayim. He wishes them well back, and then he directs his vision upwards and says, Lishuatcha kiviti Hashem, which is actually Yaakov's words from the Brachas in this week's Parsha. So, as is often the case for in the Sfardi tradition, it's a little bit more elaborate. For the rest of us, we just say labriut, somewhat more low-key, but, well, not to be sniffed at. So, in any case, why is Yaakov davening that a person should be sick? Because it's better that a person should have the time when their time comes to put their affairs in order. Otherwise, they don't really have that time. And thus, says the Medrash, Yaakov was the first person to be sick. And this is very interesting, says Oznaim LaTorah, because the Torah is actually describing Yaakov being sick before anyone else reported it, because no one had ever experienced it before. It took people a while to recognize that this is what had happened, because Yaakov was the first one. And therefore, although in the beginning of the Parsha Yaakov is already sick, it's actually not until Acharei HaDvarim Ha'ele, where people see that he's declining in that way. They've never seen anything like that before. And they say to Yosef, Hine Avicha Chole. Hine often has the connotation of a chiddush, that he really was the first sick person. And that's why the difference between the two is not that Yaakov was only sick in the second section, but people only recognized that the phenomenon had actually occurred in the second section, but already had been around already from the beginning of the Parsha, and that's why Yaakov bows down Al Rosh Hamita. So interesting comment, again, on these are details, but they all fill out the picture. Well, I'd like to move to the brachas of Yaakov for the main part of this evening. That's Perek Mem Tes. A comment on the beginning, the introduction almost of the brachos, and then we'll pay attention for a while to one of the specific brachos. So in the beginning of Perek Mem Tes, Vayikra Yaakov al Banov, he calls his sons, Vayomer, He Osfu Vaagida Lachem, Esa Sheyikra Eschem, Vaacharis Hayomer. Gather round, and I will tell you that which will befall you in the end of days. As we know, there's a well-known discussion in the Gemara that, again, impacts on our practice every day. It's a Gemara in Maseches Psachim on Daf Nun Vav, because we see that Yaakov says he's going to tell them what happens Ba'achris Hayamim. In the event, he doesn't do that. He gives them brachos, which is its own thing, but it doesn't sound like he did what he originally intended to do. And as the Gemara famously says, Bikesh Yaakov legalos lebonav ketz hayomin, he wanted to tell them about the end of days, v'nestalka mimenu shechina. But the shechina was removed, that information was withheld, denied from him to be able to pass it on to them. And Yaakov was concerned. He thought there was something wrong with one of his children, which had happened in the past. Not all of Avram's children remained in the program. He had Yishmael. Not all of Yitzchak's children remained in the program. He had Esav. And now Yaakov has 12 children, and he doesn't know for sure that all of them will necessarily be part of the continuation. And he thought that they were, one of them perhaps, or more, were the reason that the Shekhinah had been removed from him. Apparently he voiced this concern, or the sons sensed this concern, and they said, no, we're all with you. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Hear, O Israel, Hashem is our God, Hashem is one, just like Ein Belibcha Ela Echad, so too Ein Belibeinu Ela Echad. We're all on board. When he heard that, Yaakov responded, Baruch Shem Kavod Machuso Le'olam Voed. And that led to the quandary, should we say it, should we not say it? It's not in the Chumash, Baruch Shem is not in the Chumash. If you look in Chumash Devarim, where these are Psukim, Shema Yisrael, it goes straight from Shema to Ve'ahavta, so it's not from the Torah. But Yaakov said it, and they reached this compromise whereby we say it quietly, and we've discussed in the past, and from a number of different angles, how saying it quietly is a compromise ever if you're not sure whether to say something. Normally, you either say it or you don't. Saying it quietly is rarely the way forward, but it is with regards to Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso. But the reason why I mention this in our present discussion is because there is an interesting shaila that comes out. As we know, there is a halacha which forbids a child to call their parent by his first name. But actually, when we say Shema Yisrael, that itself is a question, who exactly are we talking to? For us, it's a declaration. We're not formally addressing anyone else. that notwithstanding, the original, so to speak, Shema Yisrael, said by Yaakov's sons, were said to him, and he is the Yisrael. When they said Shema Yisrael, they are literally talking to the original Yisrael, but that's his name. How are they able to refer to Yaakov as Yisrael? This question is raised by the Ritva in Maseches Yuma and Daf Lamed Zayin, and he answers that the name Yisrael is different, because Yaakov's actual name, so to speak, is Yaakov, that's his birth name. Yisrael was more of a title that was given to him by originally the Malach and then Hashem himself, Kisarisa im Elokim, and it's a title of distinction, and therefore there is no problem or abrogation of any protocol or covet to refer to him by a title of distinction, to call him Yisrael. So says the Ritva. However, the matter does not rest there, because this is only the one of a number of cases in our parsha and beyond where we see people referring to their parents by their birth names. You find even in our parsha in Perek Memches, Pasuk Tesvav, famous psukim. In fact, two psukim back to back. What does Pasuk Tesvav of Perek Memches say? Vayivarech es Yosef ayomar. So Yaakov blesses Yosef and says, Ha'elokim asher es halchu abosai lefana. So God, that my fathers went before him, Avram v'Yitzchak. My fathers, Avram and Yitzchak. Okay, Avram and Yitzchak are their birth names. And the very next pasuk, it's Yaakov talking. Hamalach hagol asim mikara, yivarech es anarim v'yikarei v'em shemi, v'shem avosai, Avraham v'Yitzchak. And so, we see that even the names Avram and Yitzchak, so Yaakov refers to them by name. How can this be? Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, in the Ksava Kabbalah, explains that we find in Poskim, with regards to referring to one's Rebbe by his name, if you add a title of respect beforehand, you can then call him by name. In fact, one of the most basic sources for this idea is from the Torah itself, because in the end of Parshas Baalosecha, when Eldad and Medad and they're prophesying and Yeshua objects, He comes to Moshe Rabbeinu and says, Adoni Moshe Kila'im, my master, Moshe. And the Poskim ask, how can you call your Rebbe by his name? You called him Moshe. But because he prefaced with the expression Adoni, if you preface with a title of respect, you can then proceed to refer to them by their first name. Says the Ksav HaKabbalah, Abba is also a title of respect. In these two psukim, Yaakov does not refer to Avraham Yitzchak. He refers to Avosai Avraham Yitzchak. Having prefaced with the title of Avosai, it's then acceptable or permissible for him to refer to them by name, Avram and Yitzchak. That is the Ksav HaKabbalah's resolution of that matter. And yet, the matter still does not rest here. Because so far, we're saying if you mention Avosai first or Abba first, then you can mention them by name. But if you look at a pasuk at the very end of our parsha, that is in Perek Nun, Pasuk Kaf Dalet, and this is where Yosef is talking to his brothers and adjuring them to take him from Mitzrayim when they ultimately leave. Perek Nun, Pasuk Kaf Dalet, Vayomer Yosef Elecha, Yosef says, Anochi Meis, I'm about to pass away, Velokim Pakod Yivkod Eschem. But Hashem will surely take account of you. V'helaschim in ha'aretz hazos. He will take you out of this land. El ha'aretz asher nishba l'Avraham, l'Yitzchak u'l'Yaakov. To the land he promised to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. There's Yosef. Yaakov is his father. There was no prefacing with a title of Avosai or anything like that. He just refers to Yaakov, just kacha, with the name of Yaakov. How can he do that? And actually, it's not just Yosef who does this. Even earlier in the Chumash Bereishis, we see this phenomenon, because in the end of Parshas Toldos, and that's when Yitzchak sends Yaakov away, and he gives him a bracha just before doing that, in the end of Toldos, Perek Kaf Ches, Pasuk Dalet, he says, V'kel Shakai Yivarechosecha, etc., etc., V'yiten Lecha Es Birkas Avraham. This is Yitzchak talking. He will give you the bracha of Avraham. Well, Yitzchak referring to his father Avraham, not Avi Avraham, just Avraham. So I think we have enough cases of people referring to their father, specifically the Avos, by their names, without any titles beforehand. How is this in line with what we know that is something that one should not do? And the answer, says the Ksav HaKabbalah, he comes in and gives it one theory which explains all of the above. And that is, with reference to the Avos, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, there is no problem to refer to them by name, even for their children. Why? Because the reason, says Ksav HaKabbalah, is why a child shouldn't refer to a parent by their name, is because the person receives their name when they're born. Which means one doesn't have to do anything in order to receive their name. They just need to exist. They get it before they've done anything. To call someone by their name gives the implication that nothing has really been achieved from the time that they've been born. They're exactly the same. And that, of course, is disrespectful for a child to do that. However, says Saksa's Ksav HaKabbalah, we have a tradition that the names of all of the three Avos, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, each one in their own way, were directed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu and were dictated by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Avraham was the name that Hashem gave Avram, turned him into Avraham. Okay, he also, in the end of Parshas Lech Lecha, told him that he was going to have a child and he should call him Yitzchak. Moreover, when Yaakov is born, the Pasuk says, in contrast to Esav, where it says in the plural, Vayikra'u Shemo Esav, they called him Esav, whoever they are, the committee of name callers. But when it comes to Yaakov, it says Vayikra, he called him Yaakov. And there is, the Medrash states, Rashi cites it as one of his interpretations, that was HaKadosh Baruch Hu called him Yaakov. each one in their own way. Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov had their name dictated by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Says the Ksav Kabbalah, that is distinction enough. And therefore, in those three particular cases, there was no problem whatsoever for one of their children to refer to them by name. Even their name is a title of distinction. I will mention one final case, and there is a chiddush here, and as is often the case, certain chiddushim are worthwhile mentioning as much for the questions that they raise as for the answers that they give. For there is one final case. Again, someone refers to his his father by name, and that's at the end of Perek Memtes. Pasuk Lamed Aleph. Let's see. Perek Memtes, Pasuk Lamed Aleph. And here is, again, Yaakov telling his children he wants them to bury him in Maris HaMachpelah. And he says, Shama Kavru Es Avram Ves Sarah. That's where they buried Avram and Sarah. Ves Sarah Ishto, and Sarah his wife. Shama Kavru Es Yitzhak Ves Rivka Ishto. There they buried Yitzhak and Rivka, his wife. The Shama Kavarti Es Leah, and that's where I buried Leah, and that's where I want you to bury me as well. Those are Yaakov's words. Once again, we have the Shaila. He refers to them burying Avram and Sarah, that's his grandfather, grandmother, and then Yitzhak and Rivka, that's his father and mother. Okay, and here, Rivka, we have no knowledge that Rivka's name was given by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay. The Ben Ish Chai, Yosef Chaim of Baghdad, one of the great Sephardi Gedolim of the last few hundred years, so he has a set of Shelos and Tshuvos. He actually has more than one set. The better known Shelos and Tshuvos are Rav Pa'alim of Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad, but he has another set of Shelos and Tshuvos called Torah Lishma. And there, he raises two questions. And these are, one could say, they are pshat questions. Very interesting questions. Look again at Pasuk Lamed Aleph. Shama Kavru Es Avraham Ves Sarah Ishto. There, this is seemingly Yaakov talking. That's where they buried Avram and his wife Sarah. Shama Kavru Es Yitzchak Ves Rivka Ishto. That's where they buried Yitzchak and his wife Rivka. Asks the Ben Ish Chai. Who's talking here? We understand that these are Yaakov's words. Yaakov's relationship with Yitzchak and Rivka is that they are his father and mother. When would a child ever refer to his mother as his father's wife? If we're already describing her, there would be correct to say, that's where they buried Yitzchak, and my mother Rivka, not his wife Rivka, that's all she is, his wife, she's your mother. Rivka is Yaakov's mother. It's an interest. It's a nuanced question, but it does actually sound rather unusual. Who's Rivka? My father's wife. She's your mother. Secondly, referring to the burial again of Yitzhak and Rivka, and Yitzhak specifically, there in Maris HaMachpelah, that's where they buried Yitzhak. Who's they? Who buried Yitzhak? If you look back at the end of Parshas Vayishlach, you will see that Yitzhak was buried by none other than Yaakov, together with Esav. But that's mefurish in the pasuk in Perek Lamed Hei Pasuk Kavtes. So he buried Yitzhak. So why does he say they buried Yitzhak? So these are very interesting questions, and it's for this reason that the Ben Ish Chai is of the understanding that these words, these descriptive words of the burial of Avram and Sarah and Yitzhak and Rivka were not what Yaakov said. They are the Torah's description of the history of who was buried in Maris HaMachpelah. The Torah says that's where they buried Avram and Sarah. That's where they buried Yitzhak and Rivka, his wife. Who is they? Well, the Torah talking, whoever buried them. But it's not the one who buried them that's talking. And she's not the mother of the one who's talking, because it's the Torah talking. It's a very interesting approach to the Pasuk, especially as the conclusion of the Pasuk, which says, Veshama Kavarti Es Leah, is without a doubt Yaakov's words. It is back to the first person. That's where I buried Leah. which means, according to the Ben Ish Chai, we have almost like a merging of narrators, almost, whereby the beginning of the pasuk is the Torah describing them from its point of view, and then we seamlessly move into Leah, where it's back to Yaakov. That is without a doubt a chiddush. But once again, the questions that it raises are very interesting questions. Why would Yaakov call Rivka Yitzhak's wife? Why would he say they buried Yitzhak when he was one of those that did? But what we do see is that according to the Ben Ish Chai, there would be no question as to how Yaakov could refer to his parents by their names. If these are the words of the Torah, it's not Yaakov talking. The Torah talks about Yitzhak and Rivka the whole time. So it's very interesting to see how this question gets further developed and fine-tuned the more psukim we bring into the fray. In any case, all of that begins with Shema Yisrael, with the Ritva, how the brothers could refer to Yisrael by name. But now, let's come to one of the Shevatim specifically, and that is Yehuda. The Bracha of Yehuda starts in Pasuk Ches. And it's actually, there's a number of psukim devoted to Yehuda, and we will not be able to comment on all of them. He's called Gur Aryeh, it's a famous expression, Gur Aryeh Yehuda, which itself is rather unusual, because an Aryeh is a lion, but Gur is a lion cub, which seems like it's diminishing, almost like the potency or the power of what Yaakov is referring to. One say he's as strong as a lion. It makes a better impression than if you say he's as strong as a lion cub. So why is he Gur Aryeh? For this reason, Rashi explains that Gur and Aryeh are actually two separate stages. It's not one thing, he's a lion cub, but rather he began as a cub, whoever he was, we'll see in a moment, and then became Aryeh. Stage one is Gur, stage two is Aryeh. And who is the reference to? Says Rashi to David HaMelech, the first of Malchi Yehuda. He began as a Gur. He began as a cub, in the sense that he was apprenticed to Shaul HaMelech. He was yet involved, but he's not yet the king. He begins as a Gur and then graduates to Aryeh. So says Rashi. Interestingly, a similar approach, again, the two-stage approach to Gur Aryeh, is found in the Perush of the Radak to this pasuk. We have the Radak on Chumash Bereishis, but he explains in a much more general or tribal way. Yehuda begins as a Gur. Yehuda doesn't start out being the king. It'll be hundreds of years before Yehuda's the king, but he already has eminence in many respects. You find, for example, Degel Machane Yehuda, right? He's the first, right? Nachshon is the first of the Nesiim, always to be mentioned. Somehow, there's eminence given to Yehuda above all the other tribes, even before he's formally appointed as a king. That's the stage of Gur. That's the stage of, it's already, in a sense, a lion in the making. And you can already see that he has this eminence. But he graduates in those early generations from Gur to full-blown Malchus in the time of David. That's the two stages of Gur and Aryeh. And one could say that this machloka, so to speak, although they're very similar, Rashi and Radak, in that they say Gur and Aryeh as two stages, they differ in terms of whether you can ascribe one of Yaakov's brachos to a specific individual in the future, which Rashi clearly says that you can. Who's the Gur Aryeh, says Rashi? It's David HaMelech. It's not Yehuda in general. It's a very specific individual within Yehuda. That's an important position vis-a-vis the brachos, that there can be a bracha to a shevet, but it's with a specific individual from that shevet in the future, in mind. And that will come back again. When it comes to the bracha of Don, Rashi explains the bracha in terms of the experiences of Shimshon, who was the most distinctive personality that we have from Shevet Dan, and it's all about Shimshon, how he etc. He moved the pillars, everything came crashing down. Whereas other Mefarshim say no, it's got to be about Dan generally because it's a bracha to the whole Shevet. So that's an ongoing. One could see a consistency in terms of this question: can the bracha to the Shevet be with one particular individual, in a sense representing that Shevet, in mind. Fine. So that's Gur Aryeh Yehuda. But now we come to a pasuk which has been the focus of a great deal of attention, and that is pasuk Yud. And we need to consider it carefully, because what the pasuk seems to be saying will generate more than a couple of questions. And what does the pasuk say? Le'yasur shevet miYehuda. The scepter will not depart from Yehuda. And the lawmaker from his descendants. Ad ki yavo Shiloh, until Shiloh comes. Veloi kasamim, and nations will assemble around him. Who is Shiloh? The Medrash says, according to Chazal, Shiloh is a reference to the Mashiach, which means that we are given some type of prediction or assurance that until that time, and perhaps until including that time, seemingly, but until that time, Lo Yosur Shevet miYehuda, the scepter of royalty will not depart from Yehuda. And the Ramban writes at length here in his Perush to this pasuk, because he identifies three different times when Malchus was not with Yehuda. The very first Malchus was not of Yehuda. It's from Binyamin. It's Shaul HaMelech. So how does Shaul being the king fit together with Lo Yosu Shevet Mi Yehuda? That's the first question. Shaul HaMelech, the first of the kings. Secondly, in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, Malchus was drawn towards or taken by Hashmonaim. That's the Hanukkah story that we've just recently come out of. Hashmonaim, of course, are Kohanim. They're not from Yehuda. How does that work together with Lo Yosur Shevet Mi Yehuda? And finally, says Ramban, the Pasuk, again, according to Chazal, means this is an assurance that will go until Yemos HaMashiach. Says Ramban, we're still pre-Yemos HaMashiach, but where's Malchus Yehuda? We don't have it. But whatever happened to Lo Yosur Shevet Mi Yehuda, which says that for this whole time period, it will not depart. These are the three very serious and significant questions raised by the Ramban. Again, number one, Shaul, who was not from Yehuda. Number two, Hashmonaim, who were not from Yehuda. And number three, nowadays, where there's no king anywhere, and certainly not from Yehuda. And the Ramban discusses these questions one by one, and each of them will give us a further crystallization as to the meaning of these words, Lo Yosur Shevet miYehuda. So, the first thing, says Ramban, with regards to the kingship of Shaul, how could Shaul be the king? What about the scepter will not depart from Yehuda? So Ramban says, if you look at the word Lo Yasur, Lasur means to depart. Something can only depart from somewhere or someone if it was with them initially. And therefore, Lo Yosur is not an assurance that there will never be a king not from Yehuda. What it does mean is that it will not depart from Yehuda, which precludes, once Yehuda does have the scepter, once Yehuda does have Malchus, so then it will not depart from him. But before he gets it, this does not preclude that there could be a king from a different tribe, because that's not called kingship having departed from Yehuda. Yehuda didn't enjoy kingship yet. And therefore, says Ramban, the first of the kings before David HaMelech initiated or inaugurated the Malchus of Yehuda, it was possible for Shaul to be king without violating the concept of Lo Yosur Shevet miYehuda. You can't depart if the thing isn't there yet. However, the question does remain, because it is certainly true that at a certain point there will need to be a king of Yehuda, but how does that work together with Shaul being king? After all, if Shaul is the king, so maybe things will stay that way. It's clear based on this pasuk, says Ramban, that the kingship of Shaul could never have endured, because to endure indefinitely means you never have scope for Lo Yosur Shevet miYehuda. It can exist temporarily, But it's got to give way some time based on this pasuk. But if that's true, says Ramban, we have another question. Because if you look in the Navi, if you look in Sefer Shmuel, you will see that the reason why the kingship was taken away from Shaul is because of things that he did wrong. He didn't wait for Shmuel before bringing the korbanos, the way that he acted with Amalek, he spared them, etc. and so forth. And Shmuel said to him that because of this, Hashem will take the kingship from you and will give it to someone else. The implication is that Shaul lost the kingship because of misdeeds, because of things that he did wrong. Whereas we're saying, even if he did everything right, the kingship couldn't have stayed with him because lo yosef shevet mi Yehuda. So how do we merge together? How do we harmonize the loss of kingship? Was it inevitable, or was it due to some type of wrongdoing? Says Ramban. To be the king over all of the Jewish people is something that could never have endured for Shaul. That's from our pasuk. Lo yosef shevet mi Yehuda. However, it is possible that Shaul would have retained some type of authority, some type of kingship, perhaps even kingship within the Jewish people. What does that mean? It means, says Ramban, that there is a group, a subset within the Jewish people. It could be Binyamin, or it could be the Benos Rochel, who are called Ephraim, and it could be that there would have been a kind of a sub-kingdom that Shaul and his dynasty would have been able to continue to reign over, even though the king of the greater Jewish people would certainly have to come from Yehuda. What's very interesting about what the Ramban is suggesting here is that the concept of the kingdom of Ephraim actually existed earlier than we normally think that it did. In other words, when we think of a kingship, of a monarchy called Ephraim, we look upon that at David HaMelech's grandchildren, Rechavam and Yeravam, and then it's split, and Yeravam is from Yosef, and Rechavam is from Yehuda, and that's the point where the kingdom was split in two, and it all starts then. That's not true. The concept of a distinct group within the Jewish people called Ephraim, or called referring to Yosef and Benos Rochel and all of that, it pre-existed for hundreds of years, certainly for many generations. And this is pointed out by Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. It's actually explicit psukim in the Navi. It's just if we don't have an orientation, we're not sure what to make of them. But you find, for example, even in Shaul's time, when he is preparing people for war, in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Yud Aleph, it tells how many people turned up for the army. And hear how it groups them. Vayu b'nei Yisrael shlosh mios elef. There were 300 from b'nei Yisrael. V'ish Yehuda shloshim elef. 30,000 from Yehuda. This is in the time of Shaul HaMelech. Yeravam hasn't been born yet. Rechavam hasn't been born yet. The split, as we normally look upon it, hasn't happened yet. So why do we already have the army being referred to as how many people came from Yisrael and how many people came from Yehuda? That tells us that there were already these two distinct groups from much, much earlier on. They just didn't fracture until the time of Rechavam and Yeravam. But this is what Ramban is saying. It could be that Shaul could have continued in some lower capacity, but because of the things that he did wrong, he lost everything. But to remain the king over everyone could never be for Shaul because of Lo Yosef Shevet Mi Yehuda. Okay, that's question one. What about Shaul? Lo Yosef hasn't kicked in yet because it doesn't belong to Yehuda to then be removed from there. But then we move to the second question. Even post Yehuda taking on Malchus, you have the Chashmonaim. And what about that? How can that happen given Lo Yosef Shevet Mi Yehuda? And here the Ramban's response is very well known, and that is that it's true. It was wrong for the Chashmonaim to take on the Malchus. In other words, in so doing, they violated the Yaakov's words of Lo Yosef Shebet Mi Yehuda. He is saying it cannot depart. They took it, but wrongfully so. Those are the words of Ramban. It's not entirely clear whether the original adopting of Malchus for any amount of time was the problem, or perhaps keeping it, because it went then from father to son for a good long while. But certainly, between the two, says Ramban, that was a violation, and moreover, harsh words, but Ramban says, they were punished. The dynasty of Hashmonai was completely wiped out. All that was left of them were servants. The Gemara famously says in Bava Basra, if a person ever claims to be a descendant of the Hashmonaim, he's declared himself a slave, because everybody else was completely wiped out by Herod. In other words, says Ramban, Yaakov cannot guarantee that no one will ever assume the Malchus. They can do what they want. They have free will. What he can say is, it will not endure, because they are offside of the way things should be. These are well-known comments of Ramban. Much to ponder there. It is in place to mention. And we didn't talk about this in Hanukkah, because I don't think this is really the ikkar of what Hanukkah is about, but it's certainly part of it. There's room to say that the Ramban's critical view of the Hashmonaim adopting Malchus, to the extent that they did, is not shared by all commentators, by all Rishonim. Specifically, the Rambam, in his introduction to the Halachas of Hanukkah, and he gives the story in brief, which he doesn't normally do, but the Rambam has told us in his introduction that if you know Tanakh and you know my Sefer, you have everything you need. So if you know Tanakh, you know the background to every other festival except for Hanukkah, because it was post-Tanakh. And therefore, Rambam says, so I'll need to tell you briefly the story of Hanukkah, which he does. And he describes, and of course, each word is weighed and measured, as is the way of the Rambam, and there's much to discuss there. But when it gets to the to the point of deliverance, says Rambam, Hashem helped them, and they defeated the enemy. Ve'he'emidu melech min ha-kohanim. And they set up a king from the Kohanim. And moreover, says Rambam, v'chazra Malchus li-Yisrael yeser al-masayim shana. Malchus came back to Yisrael for more than 200 years in one form or another. And then, says Rambam, and that's why we have Hanukkah. Umipnei zeh, based on all the above, the miracle, and he mentions the war and the oil and the malchus and the whole thing. And because of this, they instituted that these 8 days are days of simcha and halal. One cannot avoid the implications of Rambam that he does not look disfavorably on the Hashmonaim taking malchus. It's part of the celebration. It's the background to Hanukkah. And he makes a point of saying it. Ve'emidu melech min ha-kohanim, and Hanukkah is so wonderful, and that's why we have the festival. If he shared the Ramban's view, seemingly, he would not have been so celebratory about mentioning melech min ha-kohanim. According to the Ramban, that was not a good thing to do. And there's much to ponder there, but it is worthwhile mentioning that the Rambam does not seem to share Ramban's critical view of the Hashmonaim. In the end, they soured anyway. They went downhill, but that's them going downhill. That's not necessarily that it was doomed from the start based on Lo Yosef Shevet Mi Yehuda. How would the Rambam explain our pasuk? That's another question. And finally, so just to take stock of where we are, to make sure that we keep our bearings, we have discussed and dealt with two of the three questions. What about Binyamin? That's before Yehuda took Malchus. What about Hashmonaim? Quite so. That was wrong for them to do so, and it did not endure. But what about now? Now, there's no Malchus at all, and certainly not from Yehuda. Where does that leave us in terms of Lo Yosef Shevet Mi Yehuda? Says Ramban, the answer again is in the words Lo Yasur. Lasur means to depart. Whenever you see the concept of departing, that means it goes from A to B. The assurance of Lo Yasur Shevet Mi Yehuda doesn't mean that kingship will never disappear from Yehuda. It doesn't mean that. And in fact, the Torah explicitly states otherwise. Because in the Tochacha, in Parshas Kisavo, it at least gives mentions the possibility and expresses it that way. Hashem will take you and your king out. And a king, when he's in exile, that's not called kingship. In other words, it's always possible that Malchus will be suspended. And Lo Yasur doesn't say otherwise. Lo Yasur means from the time Yehuda takes on Malchus, it will never go to another tribe. That's true. But it might be suspended, and no one would be Melech, and that's the situation that we're in today. And therefore, these are Ramban's very precise, I would say, and demanding in terms of our reading of the words, understanding of Lo Yasur Shevet MiYehuda. Interestingly, there is a follow-up to this discussion. The pasuk Lo Yasur Shevet MiYehuda attracted attention and literature around it way in excess of other psukim in terms of pure parshanut, because it was actually a point of confrontation in the disputations between Jews and Christians. And Ramban's comments from that point of view are also on record. By that we mean the background is that from the 1200s roughly and onwards, there were a number of occasions where Jews, notable Jews, Jewish scholars, etc., were called to defend Judaism against claims of being anti-Christian or being wrong or so on and so forth. Of course, the Christians claimed to be the true religion by that point, and the Jews had to give an accounting for themselves. One of the classic disputations took place with the Ramban himself. This was in Barcelona in 1263. It was not the first of the disputations. There were one or two beforehand, Rabbeinu Yechiel of Paris and others, but it's a very famous. It's famous firstly because the Ramban only agreed to take part in this disputation if he was given absolute freedom of speech, and that was granted and respected at the time. Of course, the result is that he spoke his mind, he wiped the floor with whoever he was talking to, and his prize for winning was that he was expelled from Spain. And that's the point where he then moved to Eretz Yisrael in his later years. But the one who instigated this disputation was actually a Jew who became an apostate. And as we know, Jews often make the best goyim because they put all of their Yiddishkeit into Goyishkeit, and that's a very formidable thing. And so you had this Jew who'd become a Christian. His name was Pablo Christiani. That's the name he took for himself. And he made the claim to the king there, I think it was King James, that that he could prove the veracity of Christianity from the Talmud, from the Gemara, and if he was actually well versed, he had time to learn a bissel before he went the way that he did, and he knew he had the sources, he's got the Gemara, he's got Midrashim, and so on and so forth. And Ramban was called upon to respond, and this took place before the king, and again Ramban reduces him to pieces. The first point is a general point, says Ramban, and that is that if it's really true that everyone in the Talmud really believes in Christianity, so then why didn't everyone just move over? Which is, if everyone really, if that's what they really think, you see the way that they refer to in other religions generally, and Christianity in particular, it's a ludicrous concept. But he doesn't leave it at that. He discusses point by point every proof, so to speak, quote unquote, of Pablo Christiani, and the first proof came from our pasuk, specifically based on Chazal, because the pasuk says Lo Yoso Shevet MiYehuda, kingship will not depart from Yehuda ad ki yavo Shiloh, until Shiloh comes. Now, there's different interpretations of what Shiloh might be, but specifically says Pablo here, according to Chazal, Shiloh is Mashiach. Which means that if you ever see the Jewish people without a king, you can take that as a sign that the Mashiach has come. And that's really what we say. We say he came. Okay, he left a little bit for other occasions. But according to you, you're still in the pre-Messianic era. So how could Malchus go away? It says it won't go away until Shiloh comes, until Mashiach. But we say the Messiah has come. That was his claim. So the first thing, Ramban gives him a bit of a lesson in Parshanut and takes him through the Lo Yosur Shevet B'Yehuda in the way that we did. What exactly Lo Yosur means, etc. It means to depart from A to B. It doesn't mean not to dissolve, etc. I don't know if that was too in the text. But apart from that, says Ramban, if you're right, then not only have you disproven Judaism, you've disproven Christianity also, in which case no one knows anything. And the reason I say that is because you're saying that if there's no Malchus, it must be the Messiah has come, says Ramban. Okay, well, when did Malchus stop from the Jewish people? It stopped from Yehuda specifically before the Babylonian exile. That's the last you hear of a king from Yehuda. Which means, according to you, if there's no kingship, the Messiah must have come. So I guess he came earlier than both of us are saying. For us, he hasn't even come yet. But even for you, he was a few hundred years late. He's come already, and no one knows who he is. So explain. So Pablo was ready, and he has got another Gemara. And the Gemara says in Yuma that Lo Yosef Shevet Mi Yehuda can endure in the form of the Reish Gelusa. So you see that it still continued. To which Ramban says, yeah, but it continued way past the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. There's still a Reish Gelusa. Which means you're either a couple of hundred years too early or a few hundred years too late. Either way, it's not where you are. And that was the response of Ramban on that regard. He then has some choice words to say generally about the claim that Oso Ish could be the Mashiach. He has a long, it's a pella that they let him finish his sentences here. But he does say, look at all the Nevi'im. You see what they prophesy will happen in Yemos HaMashiach. It's a time of peace. Says Ramban to Pablo, more blood has been spilt in the name of more wars have started based on the Oso Ish than for anything else. That's not the reign of peace that the Navi is talking about. Okay, so that's a nugget, and again, it's very interesting to see, you know, and almost historically how the discussion continued beyond the Parshanut as we have in the formal commentary of Rambam. Perhaps let's conclude by referring back to the beginning of the brachos, Perek Memtes Pasuk Aleph. What's very interesting is the Gemara that we quoted, Yaakov, he wants to tell his children, his sons, about Ketz HaYamin, and he can't. The Shekhinah departs from him. That information is denied him. And he doesn't know why. And he thinks it's because one of his sons, perhaps, is not so much with the program, but the sons reassure him, no, Shema Yisrael, as we discussed, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, we're all in the program, and everything proceeds. There's just one Shaila. It's very interesting how easy it is to forget to ask this question. Namely, so if everyone's with the program, so why was the Shekhinah denied him? Why was he not able to give them that information? If we go back over the trail of events, he'd like to tell them, but the Shekhinah is removed from him. He thinks it's because they're not with the program, but they are. So then the question is, okay, so then why can't he tell them? It must be that something else is blocking it. And this is discussed by the Malbim. And the Malbim, the specialty of Malbim is Lashon HaKodesh, and specifically words that seem to be so close to each other as to be virtually synonymous, but each word has its hue and color and specific connotation. Have a look at Perek, the beginning of Perek Memtes. What does it say? Vayikra Yaakov Albana Vayomer, he calls them and says, hey Osfu, gather together. V'agida lachem eitzah shikra eschem b'achris hayomim. That's what he wanted to do. But he's not able to. And he shifts plan, in a sense. Pasuk Beis, he kovtsu, gather together. Vishimu b'nei Yaakov, listen, and he proceeds to give them the brachos. So what's interesting is, the perek begins twice, in Pasuk Aleph and Pasuk Beis. Pasuk Aleph, what he wanted to say, and Pasuk Beis, what he ends up saying. But the way that everyone is brought together is phrased differently. Pasuk Aleph says, hey asfu, Pasuk Bey says, he kaptsu. But Asifa is gathering together, and kibbutz is gathering together. So what's the difference between those two terms? And why does one mark plan A, and why does one the other one start plan B? Says the Malbim, there is a difference in connotation between these two terms. Asifa is not so much an issue of gathering together, but it's gathering in. When something is out there somewhere and you take it in, that's called asifa. It's not about bringing things together. And interestingly, we can see that from the Torah. Because sometimes the Torah will use the expression of asifa even when it's only talking about one thing. So it's not disparate, it's just bringing it in. In Parshas Ki Tzeitzei, if you see lost property, you don't know who the owner is, va'asavto el toch beisecha. Bring it in. You're not gathering it together. It's already together, but it's outside. You bring it in. Kibbutz has the concept of bringing together things that are disparate. And this is the difference between those two terms. And that is why initially you can see Yaakov originally assumed that his sons are not only on level in terms of Ben Adam Lamokom, but also Ben Adam Lachaveiro. He saw that there was absolute unity. That was his understanding. In which case, if that's true, there's no reason why he can't talk about the time when people are brought in. They're already as one. They let them just come back. That's Keitz Hayamim. And that's why he says, Hey Asfu. As surely as he's saying to his sons, draw near to me, because you're all together. So then he's saying, we can talk about the time where you were drawn back to Eretz Yisrael, because everyone's all together. But in the end, he saw that that wasn't true. They are all on level, Ben Adam Lamokom, Shema Yisrael. But there was something lacking, perhaps in themselves, perhaps that would come out in their descendants, that they were not yet cohesive and harmonized enough to be brought back. They need to be brought together first. And that's what the Medrash says, that what he's saying to them here is, beware of machlokas. His final words to his sons are, stay together. And how do we see that? Because he goes by saying, hey, osfu, which assumes that they're together, and we can already be brought back in. But if he's not allowed to talk about the Kates, it's because this is the problem. They're not all together. In which case, Yaakov says, okay, we need to back away from hey, osfu for a moment. We need to talk about hikovtsu. We need to talk about joining together. Because until you do that, there can be no asifa. And this, as we know, played out in the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, Sinas Chinam, which was the antithesis of kibbutz, led to the Churban. And what Yaakov is saying, and it's a message for all ages, these words, hikovtsu, are not just said to Yaakov's sons, they're said to all of Yaakov's descendants for all time. And that, of course, is certainly what to think about, certainly as we're heading into days like Asar B'Teves, so on and so forth. We are mindful that there's still work to be done. That work is not only in the realm Ben Adam Lamokom, also Ben Adam Lachaveiro, each one in their own sphere, and then all together, we should be Zoche B'Mehira, to not only Hikavtsu, but also He Osfu in the Ketz HaYomim, which should come B'Mehira.